morning, everybody. The House State Affairs Committee will please come to order. Will you please call the roll?
Representative Grunberg. Representative Christ Tompkins.
Here.
Representative Tallarico. Representative Stoops.
Here.
Representative Keller.
Here.
Chair, Representative Vasquez.
Here.
Chair Lynn.
I am here. Okay, thank you again. On this morning's calendar, in order that I'm trying to do this, would be HB 77 will be first, HB 173 will be second, HB 55 will be third, and HJR 19 will be fourth. Mm-hmm. There's no problem with that. We will ask the presenters for HB 77 to please come forth. Good morning. Please introduce yourself, present the bill.
Good morning.
And bring us up to date from where we were last time.
I'm Representative Steve Thompson from House District 2 up in Fairbanks, and my chief of staff.
For the record, my name is Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Steve Thompson.
Thank you again for having the bill one more time before you. What we have is a CS for HB 77 that removes Section 1 of the bill. Where they can put that in statute instead of in, or put it in regulation instead of statute as far
and
as.
If I mean, yes. Let's get a motion to adopt the CS.
Mr. Chair, I'd move CS, it's version H, Hotel, of House Bill 77, LS0072H, Hotel, for a working document.
Okay, again, objection for discussion. Please, and bring us up to date on the difference between the last bill and this CS, please.
Okay. Thank you, through the chair. The CS for House Bill 77 removes Section 1 of the bill since the Alaska Police Standards Council is currently working on the training component and the regulations should be adopted by July 1st of 2015. These regulations will include a disability training component, and we have agreed that this is a better policy and better placed in regulation than in statute. I'm going to have my chief of staff give you a breakdown on the sections.
For the record, Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Thompson. The two remaining sections of this bill, Section 1 provides for identification on Alaska State ID or driver's license that would be voluntary, it would be discreet, and when I checked with the people, that was what they wanted, was, you know, not the big red stripe across your license that you might see if you've done something bad. And it will alert officials that the individual with whom they are interacting has a hidden disability. Again, participation is totally voluntary. And the other one is to include in the driver's manual a section on the duties and responsibilities of drivers and pedestrians when encountering or stopped by a police officer. And DMV will also include a question on the driver's exam.
Okay.
And that is
any questions for the presenters?
Nope.
Representative Vasquez.
Just a comment on that provision, informing drivers what they need to do when they're being stopped by a peace officer, that is very, very important for anyone with or without disabilities.
Representative Vasquez, through the chair, what's one of the things when we were sitting around roundtabling it this summer that we really discovered that none of us really knew? Mm-hmm. You know, what is the procedures?
Anything else?
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to present? I have some people on the line there for questions only. I'm going to give the names and we'll talk to these folks. We'll arrange you to have Amy Erickson from the DMV for questions. We have Art DeLon from Fairbanks on the Wall Busters. And we have Kelly Azaharno, I guess it is, from Juneau. If needed, he's from, I can't see where he's from, but he must be from someplace, right? any questions from any of those people? If not, anybody else online testify?
Yeah, I have to wait for Fairbanks to send me a list.
Okay, a new list other than what I have here. Okay, in the meantime, anybody in the audience who'd like to testify? Okay, we can go at ease while we wait for the Fairbanks people.
We can just...
Many committee please come back to order. Any discussion on the bill? If not, I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I'll move HB 77, version H, out of committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal amount.
Fine, we're taking the IDs while we do the paperwork. Recognize Representative Tallarico has now joined us. Next on our agenda this morning is HB 173. The presenter can present that from here if you like, or down there, anywhere you want to, Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Chairlin. For the record, Jonathan Christ Tompkins. I'll make this quick and short and sweet for our conversation prior to the committee hearing. HB 173 addresses what was brought to our attention by a constituent in SICK regarding a loophole in, or sort of perceived loophole in cars that are leased and the registration fees that they pay. So if you're a normal person, you're leasing a car, turns out you end up paying commercial registration fees, which are substantially more than if you own the vehicle. And so,
well, I'm confused. If you're a normal person, whatever that is.
A private citizen.
Okay. Now we're going to lease a car, right? And?
And so if you're leasing a car, you pay vehicle registration fees that are far in excess of the registration fees you would pay if you just bought a car. And so this constituent was very surprised, and we went to work on the issue, and in the last few weeks we've sort of realized the extent of this change would be rather dramatic in talking with the Department of Administration and DMV and acquainting ourselves with a fiscal note associated with this bill. We'll be taking our foot off the accelerator, so to speak, but all of this happened after this bill was scheduled for a hearing. But,
I don't want to say, in other words, if I go to lease a car myself, and I've done that once, that's one registration fee, a certain amount. But if I were to, what's the other one? What's the difference between a registration fee of a car that I own or are buying and a car that I would lease?
Representative Lynn, or Mr. Chair, I've called in the cavalry, Barrett, who's studied this issue in depth for the last few weeks.
Good morning, members of the committee. Rep. Lynn.
Move the mic a little closer, please.
Sorry. My name is Barrett Wilbur. For the record, I'm staff to Rep. Chris Tompkins. I would love to answer your question, which is that if you, as a private citizen, lease a vehicle for personal use, because that vehicle, it's a commercial transaction to lease a vehicle, and you are essentially paying the car dealership for use of that car over 2 years or however long your lease is, the DMV considers it a commercial vehicle, no matter how you, a private citizen, intend to use that vehicle. So if you lease a truck that you want to drive around on the road, want to use as a family car, because the vehicle is leased, the DMV will ask you to pay commercial registration fees for the vehicle.
I'm trying to think. When I did lease a car, it had been at least 12, 15 years ago. I thought the fee was the same as a privately owned vehicle. I guess not. Could I call Amy Erickson? Are you online?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I am online.
Yeah, please introduce yourself, and would you explain this a little better for me and
sure.
The committee?
This is Amy Erickson, the Director of the Division of Motor Vehicles. The statute says that a vehicle that's in the name of a company pays commercial fees, and because leased vehicles are in a company name, and then the lessee, who is you or I, who's leasing the vehicle, we're also on the registration, but it is in a company name, which requires commercial fees to be paid.
Okay, any questions? Resident Institutes.
So I want to clarify that, and the company name happens to be the firm where you're buying the vehicle from, correct?
Or leasing.
Or leasing it from.
Through the chair, that is correct, Representative Stutes.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Representative Vasquez.
Are we talking about long-term leases? I mean, if someone was to lease a vehicle for a day or a week, I'm a little confused.
When we initially, Representative Vasquez through the chair, when we initially put together this bill, we envisioned the situation for leases, kind of a typical personal use lease, which can last, I think a typical one would be about 2 to 5 years. One of the issues with this bill that we kind of just started discussing with the DMV is what to do about the situation with shorter leases or rentals, you might say. And I think Amy Erickson would probably be more adept at answering that question than I am.
And before she does, go ahead and finish your question. You're not going to go ahead.
Perhaps I should clarify. Now I'm understanding better what this aims to remedy or address. We're talking basically long-term leases. It appears for at least 2 years. Is that what we're addressing here?
Representative Vasquez through the chair. This bill doesn't include any specific time limit on leases. So I don't feel comfortable saying a precise number or amount of time that a specific lease would be.
So hypothetically, you can lease it for a week, and this would apply. We should probably have DMV address.
We'll say that for her. I want to get these two here, and then we'll go back to DMV. Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my next question would be then, and I don't even know if you can answer this or if DMV can, but if you're being required to pay on this vehicle as if it's a commercial vehicle, are you then required to insure it as if it's a commercial vehicle as well?
Good question. You want to say that for Ms. Erickson? Or let me go to Representative Keller.
I was just sitting here thinking about the analogy of leasing a house. The property taxes on the house or the rental unit wouldn't be visible necessarily in the rent payment. And the reminder from me as I was reading this through is that the person paying the tax is the lessee, not necessarily the leaser. And I would assume that the lessee could design his contract on the lease to emphasize the tax or not. You know, so it's not that necessarily that we are currently taxing individuals who happen to lease. We tax companies and we tax commercial companies that lease cars. So, yeah, I can see the glitch you'd get into real quick. And as far it kind of goes to your question too. If I rent an apartment, the rent and the liabilities and that is different variations of risk for the leaser and the lessee.
Okay. Ms. Erickson, can you address any or all of those inquiries?
I can attempt to, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
When we talked with Representative Clay Tompkins this morning, we were talking about the rental car versus a leased vehicle concept, because with a rental car, they're commercial vehicles and they pay commercial fees, whereas if you lease a vehicle, presumably the company would be paying the higher fee for the commercial rate because they are the ones who are leasing the vehicle, but they pass it on to the consumer. So I agree with Representative Keller, who said that you could apply that to your contract. I think that's probably the most appropriate way to handle it. And to speak to Representative Vasquez, DMV registrations are not for weeks at a time. They're for 2 years, or could be 1 year for a commercial vehicle.
Okay. Any other questions? Ms. Erickson, why she done one? Okay. There's some other folks online. They might want to contribute to this. Okay. That's the only one I have online right now. Okay, I'm going to close public testimony. Any discussion from the committee? The sponsor of the bill requested to hold the bill. But any questions to him before we do that? Representative Keller.
Yeah, I just want to say, Representative Chris Tompkins, there's a lot of reasons for bringing bills forward, and this is a valid one. We're all smarter than we were this morning when we got here. So thank you, and I appreciate your willingness to set this aside.
Any other questions or comments? Any closing statement? Representative Chris Tompkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the committee's attention. We try to sort of, whenever someone in the district comes to us, we try to chase with a lot of eagerness what the base of the issue might be, and we thought this might be a loophole to close, and we realized it's much larger than a loophole, applies to a lot of people, and there's different ways of looking at it. So it was, thank you for taking the bill up.
One of the best things of being in the legislature, all the things you learn or hear about that you know never would have heard about before unless you were here, the variety of issues that come up is just incredible. When I'll tell the story, when I first got elected, my first customer, you might say, my office, I was a little bit nervous about being a new legislator, and this lady came in and she wanted to talk about body piercing and tattooing, and I really didn't know what to say, not much about this, and she went out, and my chief of staff ushered in the next visitor, my second visitor in my legislative career, and they want to talk about the gas pipeline. I think, wow, there's a lot of things we talk about down here, so it's a wonderful experience, I think, for all of us. Yeah. Any other comments? Okay, we're going to hold the bill, and we hope to see this back again as soon as possible. Thank you. The next bill up for discussion is HB 55. Who are the presenters on HB 55? Good morning.
Good morning.
Please introduce yourself. Tell us about this proposed bill.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to speak in front of the House State Affairs Committee this early morning. You guys, we thought we'd be at the very end of the agenda, and you guys are just so efficient. I just want to thank you for the opportunity once again to offer House Bill 55 up for consideration. It's an act relating to compensation for those who are wrongfully convicted and imprisoned. I wanted to start by just having everybody imagine and take maybe 20 or 30 seconds in your head to think about the last 20 or 30 years of your life. For the young member, he won't get to 30, but think about the marriages, the weddings, the births of your children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, Mr. Chair. Think about the graduations, deaths, retirements, and other very significant events that have happened. The Internet was created. 9/11 happened. Globalization and technology have exponentially increased our efficiency.
And if I might add, could you please put your name on the record? I failed to have you do that.
Representative Scott Kawasaki, House District 1 in Fairbanks.
Go ahead.
We've all been lucky and very fortunate to have witnessed and experienced all these events, but imagine what it would have been like if all that time, the 20 to 30 years, had been spent behind bars, a small 8x12 prison cell for a crime that you didn't commit. That's the problem that this bill seeks to correct. The lost years, the experiences that a wrongfully incarcerated Alaskan suffers, that will suffer through. When we make a mistake at home, we spill milk, break a plate, don't do our laundry, there are consequences to those actions. However, when the state legal system makes a life-altering mistake and incarcerates an individual, an innocent Alaskan, there aren't any consequences for the state for stealing those years away. This bill creates a mechanism to provide financial compensation for those lost years to help the wrongfully convicted get back on their feet. An exoneree would receive $50,000 a year with a cap of $2 million. This meets the federal recommendations set by the Federal Justice for All Act of 2004, and it's most commonly used threshold in the 30 other states that currently have wrongful compensation, wrongful conviction compensation statutes. While no amount of money can truly compensate for the time spent wrongfully incarcerated, the concept is to provide some finances to help the wrongfully convicted get back on their feet, reintegrate into society, and start their life after prison. House Bill 55 proactively protects the state coffers by instituting a compensation plan to help the reintegration process rather than waiting for exonerees to sue the state in civil court for civil damages. According to the Alaska Innocence Project, the average statute amount is roughly $330,000 per exoneree, while the average civil award amount is about $3.6 million. House Bill 55 would establish a $50,000 a year compensation and then protect the state from future civil suits. While there haven't been any exonerations in Alaska that would have fallen under this current statute as written, the overall rising wave of exonerations over the past 15 to 25 years means that it's a matter of when, not if, an exoneration happens in Alaska. House Bill 55 is a proactive measure that rights the state's wrongs and protects us from future lawsuits while fulfilling our moral duty as stewards of the public justice system. Thank you for the opportunity to address the chair and members of the State Affairs Committee. I'm happy to take questions, and I know that we have online at least one person to testify, and that's Bill Oberle from the Alaska Innocence Project.
Thank you very much for bringing the bill forward. I just saw on TV, I think, within the last week or so, somebody in some other state outside who'd been exonerated after something like 30 years on death row. And I don't know how you can compensate, somebody like that. And I don't know how we came to the formula that you came up with to compensate me, because I suppose it depends on, how long you've been incarcerated, what your age were when you were incarcerated, what your occupation was, physical condition was, or anything else. There's so many variables here. And so how did we arrive at, did you say $50,000 a year?
Sure.
How did we arrive at that number?
We use the number as a baseline because it's roughly the average of the other 30 states that have incorporated statutes.
How did they get to it?
Well, I mean, it's definitely a complex formula. If it were left to civil litigation, I think Mr. Oberle might be able to speak to this. They do have those factors. They decide if you're in the prime of your life, your earning potentials were higher, so you can sue for a higher amount, rough generally. So this is just a baseline starting number. Again, there's 30 states that currently have statutes, and we just picked one right in the center of the fold, in the median.
It's so complicated because, like I said, if you're 20 years old and you get wrongfully incarcerated, say for, I'll just pick a number, 10 or 20 years, that's pretty bad. But what if I got incarcerated at age 82 and 20 years, how could I be compensated? You see what I'm getting at? A lot of it depends on what age you are when you are incarcerated.
And Mr. Chair, I think I would have a little bit more detailed answer. My name is Riley Leonard, staff to Representative Scott Kawasaki. We came up with the $50,000 per year threshold because that was the amount that Congress established in 2004 as kind of the baseline for each year wrongfully incarcerated.
For federal criminals?
For federal crimes. And then they also established a $100,000 per year threshold for time spent on death row. So they saw that as, much more severe, as it rightly should be. And some states have adopted that standard as well, where you have a little bit of a bump for each year spent on death row. We decided to just keep it simple, and we don't have the death penalty, so decided to stay with $50,000 a year.
Any questions from the committee? Danny Vasquez, you have some experience in this type of thing more than the rest of us, I think. Do you have any comment on this?
I just know that in the state of Alaska is extremely difficult to convict someone, given our judiciary and given our rules of discovery and whatever. I think it's more common down below, but I can foresee in the future where we may have somebody wrongfully convicted. But
It's extremely hard to convict somebody in the state of Alaska.
I guess that's good or bad, depending on whether you're innocent or guilty.
I'm just saying it's very, very hard.
Yeah. Okay, anybody else on the committee? Okay, why don't you just stay there? I'd like to call. Well, I have some people here for questions only. We have Kathleen Frederick. Do you have any, up in Palmer, do you have any comments? I see for questions only. Is she online? Does she?
Yes, this is Kathleen Frederick.
Is it Frederick, you said?
Kathleen Frederick.
Yeah, okay, Kat. Do you have any, I know it's questions only, do you have any comments on what you've heard so far?
No, I don't. I think from the perspective of the Office of Administrative Hearings, which is the reason why we didn't put a fiscal note in, although it would have impact on hearings, is there's no way for us at the present time to determine how many claims would result out of this.
I guess there's no way to know.
That's right.
There's no question for her. I'm going to go to Bill Oberle. Introduce yourself and tell you whom you represent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bill Oberle. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Innocent Project. And this is an issue that is very important to us, and I think the significance was laid out well by Representative Kawasaki. This is not a conservative or a liberal issue. This is not a criminal prosecution or criminal defense issue. This is a justice issue. The Innocence Project brought an individual named Steve Barnes up to Alaska. He was exonerated in New York after spending, I think, 24 years in prison in New York.
I think I met him when he was up here.
I think you did, Representative Lynn, yes. And I don't know if you remember, Representative Lynn, when he was here, someone asked him, you know, did you get compensated for this? And you know, that's always a question for these individuals. And he said, yes, but before we go any further with that, let me ask you, what would I have to pay you to give up your end of your teens, your 20s, and actually I think it was all of his 20s, all of his 30s, and into his 40s, and put to sit in prison? And that was a sobering question for everybody there, because there is not enough money to sit in prison for a crime you did not commit. The chairman asked about the amount. The federal government set this amount, as Representative Kawasaki said, under President Bush. Interestingly, Texas, which is the state with the most exonerations, started at $50,000. They are now awarding $80,000 for each year of wrongful conviction in their state, and that's the state that has the most exonerations. So they've heard the stories, they understand what people have given up over these years in sitting in jail for crimes they did not commit, and they have raised their annual amount. And again, I would refer to Representative Wynn's reference to the recent individual who was exonerated after 30 years on death row. That was, I believe, Anthony Ray Hinton in Alabama. And he sought recovery through the judge in the case, and the judge awarded Mr. Hinton $1,000 per day for every day he was in prison. Now, without a statute, those are the kind of awards that can be realized out there. So this statute recognizes for the individual who is wrongfully convicted that he or she should be compensated for the time that was wrongfully taken away from them. But it also provides the state with a known amount and a satisfactory amount, I think, but not at the high end. And in response to Representative Vasquez's statement, I agree it is the criminal justice system is difficult to get a conviction. When one has gotten it, it's generally obtained through good, hard police and prosecutorial work, and the vast, vast majority of them are accurate. But our system is not perfect. And as Representative Kawasaki said, when we make a mistake, it is our moral duty to correct that. So if members of the committee have any questions, I'd be happy to ask them. That's the end of my statement.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Tallarico.
Just curious if we have any numbers for those that have been wrongfully convicted and exonerated, or if we have ever been in the process of a civil suit due to that that particular situation, if you would know, Mr. Oberle.
In the state of Alaska?
Yes.
Through the chair, Representative, there have been no exonerations to date in Alaska. We feel we have identified a few wrongful convictions in Alaska, and we're determining at this point if we can prove those in court. So there may be a situation coming up where this statute would be put into play, but there has not been any yet. And as I said before, wrongful convictions are rare. Our system generally works as it should.
Okay, thank you.
I don't know if that answered the question. But.
Yeah, it actually did. And are you aware of any? Well, if we haven't, have we had some civil suits that you're aware of that we've had to deal with concerning this particular topic, or probably not, since we haven't done an exoneration yet?
I don't believe there have been civil suits. I know that there probably have been for wrongful arrests or those kind of things, but that's not what we're dealing with here. This is more an error of the whole system and of sort of a monumental error that leads to a wrongful conviction and an extended period of time in prison. And we haven't had any of those yet, as far as I know.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Keller.
Yeah, Mr. O'Reilly, thank you. Is it, have you thought about and worked through the issue of whether or not, this is new to me and I, in processing, and would this provide an incentive for lawyers looking for wrongful convictions?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, did you ask for lawyers?
Yeah, well, say a person is anybody. I mean, wouldn't this provide an incentive for more litigation? To prove wrongful convictions. Because of the pocket of money that's there?
Wrongful convictions are all the work I do, Representative Keller, and I can tell you it is one of the most complex and difficult cases to establish. I don't think there's a lawyer out there who is struggling enough to undertake this as a money-making proposition. They're very difficult cases. They take I think it was Centurion Ministries who does this work out of the Midwest said that their average case takes 12 years, and that's the exoneration. I can't imagine that anyone would undertake a case like this as a way to make money. There, it just wouldn't be it wouldn't be reasonable.
Thank you for that response. That helps.
Any other from the committee?
No.
I see we have Hillary Martin, Les Legal, for questions. Any questions for her? Anybody else online? Anybody in the audience like to testify on this? Okay, we're going to close public testimony. Committee discussion. What's the wish of the committee on this? Everybody's speaking too loudly here. Somebody want to make a motion?
If I could, just a matter of discussion, and maybe I should have asked this of the sponsor, but there's nothing, I don't think, that would prevent this if there was a wrongful conviction to make reparations with legislation in a case-by-case basis. I'm struggling with, making provisions for something that has not happened, I don't think there's any reason why that couldn't be. There couldn't be reparations in unusual circumstances.
I can attempt that through the chair, Representative Keller. I don't think you'd want to do it on a case by case basis. I think having a real prescriptive way, which is uniform amongst any person, any wrongfully convicted individual, is the best way to go. And I think that 30 other states have agreed to that. And President Bush, in 2004, in passing and signing the Federal Act, recognized that too.
Okay. Trying to find the bill here. Okay. Any other comments from the committee? Okay. Representative Christ-Tompkins?
Are you still entertaining a motion, Mr. Chair?
Yes, I am.
I move House Bill 55, L29/LS0222/A is an alpha from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note, which I don't have.
Any objections from the committee?
For the record, what's the fiscal note?
Yes. What is the fiscal note? Zero?
With attached zero fiscal note.
Very good. Okay, without objection, the bill passes from committee. We'll take a short idea while we do the paperwork. Next up will be HGR 19. Thank you. To order. Our next bill on the agenda is HJR 19. And Representative, would you introduce yourself and introduce the bill, please?
Representative Feingold.
And move the microphone closer to you. There you go.
Representative Feingold from Eagle River. And I am here to speak on House Joint Resolution 19.
Okay. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the State Affairs on this early morning. It's a pleasure to be here. I do appreciate hearing this. Basically, what House Joint Resolution is it helps determine how long we want our reserves to last. As you know, we're in a fiscal crisis right now, and thank goodness we have the Constitutional Budget Reserve. And what House Joint Resolution 19 does is it gives the people of Alaska the opportunity to vote if they want a cap on our Constitutional Budget Reserve. This is going to impact their lives in the big picture with this fiscal crisis. Taxes are being proposed and many other things to solve our fiscal crisis right now. And as we all know, it's way too easy to dip into our savings during tough times. So House Joint Resolution 19 proposes to place a constitutional amendment before the voters in the fall of 2016 general election. It amends Article 9, Section 17B of the Alaska Constitution and would place an annual spending cap of 10% on the balance of the Constitutional Budget Reserve. Currently, the Constitutional Budget Reserve may provide the amount necessary when added to other appropriations to provide for total appropriations equal to the amount of appropriations made from the previous fiscal year. The result of this fund is being dependent on the backfill to a lot of Alaska's large budget deficits. Our current fiscal situation has been masked by a false sense of security cushioned by our savings. At the end of the fiscal year, the statutory budget reserve will be diminished. We must remember that as our oil revenues diminish, it is the men and women of this great state who will bear the cost of big government. This legislation will allow Alaskans to determine if they wish to place a cap on the constitutional budget reserve in order to save for future generations. And with that, I'm here for questions.
Okay, let's go on the table. Any questions? Representative Keller.
Representative Reitwell, you said several times you call it a cap on the reserve. It's a cap on the spending, right?
Correct, cap on the spending.
Right.
That is correct. Thank you. So it's an annual spending cap of 10%.
What would that be in approximate dollars today?
Today, like, I believe there's $14 billion in the reserve, so we'd be able this year to dip in $1.4 billion to spend in our savings towards.
Okay.
I got another one.
Huh?
I'm sure you can have another question.
Yes, go ahead.
President Reinbold, I'm sure you thought about this, but what happens if there's a catastrophe or, somebody needs to, we get in a situation where, we're emergency type situation where we're needing to cover the costs?
I read in the Constitution, and there is provisions in the Constitution in regards to that, where the governor can declare an emergency.
So either a state emergency or a national emergency declared, this would be non-void?
Invasions and things like that. It's outlined very carefully.
Okay. Reverend Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Reinfeld. Good morning.
Good morning.
I was thinking through this 10% of the current fund, statutory guidance, and as sort of a math problem. And if you take 10% out, say you take out your maximum, your 10% 1 year, the fund's a little bit smaller, and then 10% next year is going to be a little bit smaller than what you drew out the previous year. Eventually, you're going to get to a smaller number, and the amount you're going to be able to draw out of the fund is going to seem to be inconsequential, and you're never actually going to get to zero. I can sort of see the graph in my mind. I'm maybe not finding the right words to describe it, but I'm wondering if you've thought through that scenario or if I'm misunderstanding the intention behind the bill.
Mm-hmm. Please respond.
Thank you, through the chair. There is also requirements to put money back in for withdrawals, and it's clearly outlined, so that is taken care of. And the big question is what this really does is it's nothing that is going to impact this year or next year. This goes in 2016. It just gives the people the opportunity to vote if they want a 10% cap on the spending limit annually.
Anything else? Anything else from the committee? Representative Calarico.
Just if I can understand it more, and I think I understand.
Because it's really almost a finance bill.
Well, it kind of is, yeah, but I think I understand the logic of if you take 10% off 1 year and that number is smaller the next year, what the real signal that it gives you is your finances aren't going so well anyway. And you are going to need smaller increments as you go in order to extend that out. I think the replacement of the fund and getting money back into it is one of the key things here because as that tapers down, if that amount gets smaller and smaller that you can take out of there, you obviously the rest of your finances are also struggling too. So I'm assuming there's a natural inclination to cut back as much as possible.
Okay. Thank you. Any response to that, Representative Reinbold?
Well, basically, but in the if you read this, basically it's the overview of the governor's request. On page 72 in section 29, it deals specifically in regards to the deposits that go back into the budget reserve. So there's a careful formula here that they use for that.
Okay, very good. Representative Keller.
In principle, does this not reduce the power of the legislature? Because, right now we have the responsibility to be able to choose how much money comes out of the Constitutional Budget Reserve and that appropriations power is given to the legislature. This does seem to restrict it. right?
Well, through the chair, thank you for the question. Really, the power does belong to the people. I mean, that's the whole purpose of the Constitution. And this just gives the people the opportunity to decide, do they want a cap, an annual cap of 10% spent out of this reserves? Because our spending, what we do here, is going to impact the people. And so this simply gives the people the opportunity. But it requires, because it's a constitutional budget reserve, there has to be, you know, a majority, a two-thirds, or I think it's three-quarters majority, to pass a constitutional budget amendment.
Could this be done by a public initiative?
From my understanding, I'm not a legal expert, but anything changing the Constitution has to come through the legislature first. It cannot be started on...
Like anything else?
Anything constitutional. If it affects the Constitution, it must come through the legislature first.
Representative Keller.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I really would like us... I suggest that we move the bill. And it's a worthy discussion, and I think it has a discussion in judiciary, and it's got a discussion coming in finance. So I just wanted to notify the chair that I'm willing to move it. So.
Okay, so you're recommending to hold the bill?
No, I'm sorry. I'm recommending we move the bill.
Move the bill.
Yeah.
Okay. I have a question.
Representative Vasquez.
I'll ask the right elephant in the room. If this was to apply this year, for argument's sake, what would then, obviously, our deficit is way beyond a $1.4 billion, that is more like 3.5 or 3.6, then what would be the practical consequences of having a provision like this applied to the legislature?
You know, that this is something that would be set up so people would understand the Constitution. It's for future planning. I'm not on finance and don't have to make those tough decisions right now, but this would be for future planning. It's about the future of the state and whether the people of Alaska want a 10% cap on whatever in the constitutional budget reserve, just so it lasts longer.
So basically, after the legislature, assuming it gets passed in the legislature, then it would be placed on the ballot?
Correct. 2016.
Okay.
Right. Anybody else? Okay. Anybody online to testify? Anybody in the audience to testify? I'm going to close public testimony and discussion from the committee. I'll entertain a motion if you'd like.
Mr. Chair. I move HGR 19 version W out of committee with individual recommendations and attached, I believe there is a fiscal note on this one.
Zero.
It is zero. Okay. Zero fiscal note.
Okay. With no objection, it passes from committee. Do you have the potential schedule here?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Well, we're going to have an interesting time on April 9th. Everybody set your clocks. We're going to be hearing SB 6 Daylight Savings Time on April 9th.
Is it? What time will it be?
I'm going to hit you with a gavel there. Okay. If nothing else comes for the committee, we are adjourned. Stick around for the paperwork.